Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So, thanks for coming along tonight, and Barry O'Farrell, the opposition leader, is going to speak for us. And Barry's spoken for the Sydney Institute before, but not as opposition leader, although he spoke for us as deputy opposition leader, I think. So welcome back. You know him well, so I'll be very brief in introducing him. Barry was elected the member for Northcote in 1995. He became the member for Ku-ring-gai in 1999. And of course he was elected leader of the opposition in April 2007. And has become one of the best known figures in New South Wales in that time. And tonight he's going to speak for us on the topic of good governance as the foundation for good government. Many thanks, Barry.
Thank you, Jared. It's always a pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute. It's always a pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute talking and not being talked about. It's always good to be at the Sydney Institute preparing yourself to face up to Jared's questions. Can I acknowledge a large number of parliamentary colleagues in the room and just do one, by name, and that is Gillian Skinner, who's my deputy leader of the opposition. Can I acknowledge two former activists on the front line of politics, one from the state, Terry Sheehan, from the other side of the aisle, and, of course, my feisty friend, Michael Bone, who started this evening well, and I hope he's got over it by the time we get to questions. The Institute has always been important to me. I can't remember, Jared, how long my membership's been in the black with you, but it's important to me because I think ideas are the lifeblood of a strong and healthy democracy and are essential in the delivery of good government. And by fostering and encouraging public debate, I think the Sydney Institute has a remarkable role within the Sydney and New South Wales intellectual circles, and I certainly hope that given the current economic downturn, given the fact that it's one of those these days rare or few institutions that doesn't receive public funding, that it continues to prosper. Tonight, I've gone out on a limb by choosing a topic as dry as governance. But for me, talking about the importance of good governance is essential. But before you collectively sigh, text loved ones and tell them to make sure that Grey's Anatomy is being taped. Can I at least say to you that why I think this topic is so important? I think good governance is the foundation and is the prerequisite of good government. And it's imperative to rebuild good governance. The imperative to rebuild good governance has never been as strong in this state as it currently is. When you examine the many problems with which this state is confronted, whether it's the crisis in the health system, the congestion on our roads, or the collapse in our budget, too many of them stem from a fundamental problem and breakdown in our system of governance, a lack of transparency, accountability and honesty in the way in which government's been administered in this state. As a result, the divide between politicians and the community, in my view, has never been greater. Never has the community's faith in elected representatives been lower, and never have the people been so disengaged and alienated from what goes on in this building. It's essential to restore public confidence in the institution that is government and Parliament in New South Wales. Without that trust, it'll be near impossible for government, any government, to do the necessary work of reform to right the many wrongs in New South Wales. We can't unshackle New South Wales. We can't realise the opportunities of this society without public trust. And first and foremost, that means getting the business of government right. At the outset, let me put on the record my surprise that those in business haven't had more to say about the issue of governance in this state. Of course, Labor shows no such reticence when it comes to commenting on problems of governance in the private sector. The Prime Minister's recent opus in the monthly magazine laments a system that he says led, quote, to greed of epic proportions, end quote. No one would or should condone corporate greed, but is the greed for money a worse sin than the greed for the power that we've witnessed in this state? Unquestionably, an organisation or an individual that fails to disclose information for monetary gain shouldn't be tolerated. But equally, a politician or a government that intentionally misleads or withholds information with the sole view of obtaining or retaining power shouldn't be tolerated either. In recent years, there hasn't been nearly enough public scrutiny of the ways in which government bend the truth to suit their own political advantage, or on the rise of a political culture that puts the retention of power ahead of the public interest. Activities that beg a reflection on those famous words of Acton, that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. My simple message tonight is that good governance leads to good government. I'm determined to ensure that a change of government in 2011 is more than a change of faces. A Liberal Nationals government will be committed to ushering in a new era and a new ethic of new governance arrangements. They'll be based on three central pillars. Firstly, transparency and adherence to the doctrine of open government, because we believe it's the best way to drive better performance and greater efficiency in public administration. Secondly, accountability, because transparency is only effective when matched with enforcement. We need to ensure there are mechanisms to reward top performance and remedy underperformance. And thirdly, and most importantly, honesty. People often remind me that the task that we'll face when we win government in 2011 will be huge. We're likely to be left with a broken budget, substandard infrastructure, and continuing crisis in essential services like hospitals and transport. But it won't be fixed without the public's trust. The community needs to know that our actions will be guided by putting them back at the centre of public administration again. Now, a recent community survey on which professions the public trusted the most said what's obvious to most in the community, but what comes with pain to those of us who work in this building. Of 30 professions, including car salesmen and psychics, politicians finished dead last, even behind our friends in the media, but only just. We need to convince the electorate of New South Wales that this building and all that it entails doesn't exist to serve special interests, party apparatchiks, or even the elected members who fill its chambers. We need to ensure that Parliament does truly belong to them and that the work of government puts public interest first. I want to start by expanding on this issue of transparency. Those who have worked in both the public and private sectors understand they are fundamentally different. The private sector relies on market forces to drive efficient and effective outcomes. It relies on the common benchmark of financial performance to allow customers and investors to evaluate companies. The administration of government is different. Generally, governments operate in areas or markets that provide public good or deliver social objectives. In the absence of a clear profit-driven bottom line, the question then becomes, how does government drive better performance in the delivery of services to families and business? A key part of that answer lies in transparency, providing taxpayers with the tools to see through the activities of government and accurately evaluate its performance. Putting constraints on the type of politicisation of public administration that's contributed to so many problems across New South Wales. We tend to assume, I think, that the combination of advances in technology and media scrutiny would lead to an increased transparency in the operation of government. But that isn't the case here in New South Wales. Our state government has actually wound back its openness and the transparency of government. So, for instance, in recent years, the budget papers have been reformatted, with large tracts of information removed, making it harder for anyone to accurately assess program performance. Or there's the continued resistance to allowing patients and others to access data so such as hospital infection rates, which would permit them to assess our system against those interstate or overseas. But it's in the area of freedom of information, FOI, that Labor's become increasingly creative in its refusal to release information. Recently, one of our applications under the FOI Act was refused not because the document was cabinet incompetence, but because in the future it might become cabinet incompetence. Little wonder then that the New South Wales Ombudsman's found that there's been a significant and disturbing downward trend in FOI compliance in New South Wales, with nearly 50% of requests either partially or fully refused. And poor response to FOI applications is but one part of the overall culture of concealment that's developed under Labor. It's the type of behaviour that students of politics might expect of fragile democracies in other parts of the world, but not of the mother of governments in this country. Yet Labor's decision to cloud its administration's operation has, in my view, been to its own detriment. In the short term, it does allow them to paper over the cracks in the system and avoid scrutiny. But in the long term, it hides the failures in government, not just from the public, but from those who are running it. The first step in fixing the problems is candidly acknowledging what they are in the first place, and greater, not less, transparency is the key. Now, the Liberal Nationals have already released substantial policy in these areas, demonstrating how we would operate in government differently from those who are currently there. As the heirs of those who first introduced FOI to this state, we're committed to a complete overhaul of the Act, with the aspirational goal of making the very need for FOI virtually redundant. This means adopting the guiding principle that government should proactively disclose and make available information to the public as a matter of course and culture. The onus needs to be reversed if we are to make FOI the community's democratic right of last resort, not their only way to access information that's in their interest. We've committed ourselves to appointing an open government commissioner to make sure agencies operate in line with our principles. We've also committed to a lobbyist register that captures all individuals seeking to influence the outcomes of government. And I emphasise the all. Labor's belated action on this front, flattering though its Me Tooism is, only extends to professional lobbyists. It ignores others, whether former ministers and MPs, or unions and industry associations, whose dealings with governments should equally be subject to full public scrutiny. We've also committed ourselves to strengthening the role of ICAC, another of those critical institutions established in this state by the Liberal National Parties. We're determined to end Labor's Pontius Pilate approach to allegations of corruption in New South Wales. While the ICAC Act requires senior public services, as a matter of obligation, to bring allegations of corruption to the Commission's attention, it doesn't impose the same obligation upon ministers. After I introduced a private members bill last year to extend that obligation to ministers, the Rees government finally acted. It claimed its amendments, which were passed in December of last year, would achieve the same objective. It made those claims, despite my strenuous objections during debate, which actually interrupted our question time, that they wouldn't do any such thing. 3 months on, I regret that I've been vindicated. An issue surrounding political donations to a minister and allegations of improper lobbying were again at the centre of media attention, a bit like a rerun of an old soap. The minister concerned, publicly and prominently, promised to report the matter to ICAC for investigation. 2 days later, the commission itself took the unprecedented step of issuing a statement saying that the letter it had received from that minister did not constitute a referral of an allegation of corruption for investigation to ICAC. But instead of insisting the minister do the right thing and abide by the claims that were made 3 months earlier when he amended his own ICAC Act, Nathan Rees defended her incompetence and said the government would not formally refer the matter for investigation. So all the public's left with at the end of that episode is another allegation of Labor corruption and no process to ensure them whether or not their elected representative acted correctly or corruptly. In government, will it reintroduce legislation to prevent such malfeasance in future and take other action to ensure that ICAC's effectiveness and standing is increased? Now, I couldn't disagree more with those, some who sit in Parliament, who like to argue that the creation of ICAC was Nick Reiner's greatest mistake. The public need, the public deserve, an anti-corruption watchdog they can trust to proactively work to prevent corruption and to fearlessly expose corruption whenever and wherever it occurs. We're also committed to strengthening whistleblower legislation. Just yesterday, outside this place, Gillian Snedden protested. Most of you won't know Gillian Snedden. Gillian Snedden was the electorate officer of Milton Orcopolis. Gillian Snedden was the courageous individual who brought to the attention of authorities the despicable actions of that former Labor minister. And Gillian Snedden is the person who's been hung out to dry by this Labor government, by her Labor employees, all because she told the truth. Now, the Liberal Nationals are determined to overhaul the state's whistleblower legislation because of the treatment of Gillian Snedden and others who risked all for one ambition alone, and that was the public good. Those making protected disclosures about official wrongdoing should be supported, valued and protected. And that's why, as part of our approach, we'll establish a separate public interest disclosure unit within the Ombudsman's Office to assist those wanting to blow the whistle on corrupt conduct, recommended in three separate parliamentary reviews since 1994, but not enacted. We'll introduce standard guidelines across New South Wales government agencies about the way disclosures are investigated, handled and reported upon, because they simply don't exist now. And we'll introduce the right for whistleblowers to seek damages where they've suffered detrimental action in reprisal for making those protected disclosures. We're the only state where that right doesn't exist. Whistleblowers are community heroes. They risk their livelihood for no reward other than the knowledge that they've done the right thing, and the least we can do as government or alternative government is protect them. Now, the initiatives I've outlined are designed to improve the performance of government by increasing the level and quality of information in the public domain and protecting those who provide it. However, accessibility of information is but one part of the argument. What's done with the information, how it's put to use, is critical. That's why the second pillar of our approach is about accountability. There's no point in providing information, measuring performance, if top performance isn't rewarded and underperformance isn't resolved. Departments, agencies, authorities and individuals need to be held to account for their actions. Labor's failure on this front is so self-evident, it barely warrants discussion. Of course, when politicians say that, we're going to discuss it. Minister after minister has been promoted despite the legacies of their past mistakes. For example, Eric Roosendahl and Joe Tripodi, two names that are synonymous with scandals such as Orange Grove, the Cross City Tunnel, and Labor's donations for decision culture, are promoted, not demoted. New South Wales Labor, in fact, defies Galileo's theory of gravitation. Here, Labor fails upwards, not downwards. If we're to fix the state's problems, we need to put an end to this and to restore ministerial accountability to New South Wales. Nowhere is it more important than in the state's economy, which is why when we released our economic framework for the state, we committed ourselves to ensuring that all cabinet ministers will be accountable for fiscal direction and infrastructure delivery. It's necessary to end the charade of Nathan Rees, who upon becoming Premier pretended to be ignorant about the state of New South Wales finances despite having sat at the cabinet table for 18 months. It wouldn't be an acceptable defence from a director of a collapsed company, and it won't be a defence under the next Liberal National Government. Unlike our opponents, we understand the privilege of being elected to government comes with the responsibility, and that's incumbent on ministers to bear the responsibility for the decisions that cabinet takes. It's why you end up with a $1 billion blowout on what was meant to be a Parramatta to Chatswood Railing, but ended up as an Epping to Chatswood Railing, because no one's kept an eye on it, no one's held accountable. Four transport ministers, but no one held accountable for a three-year delay, a $1 billion project on a project that ultimately was half what was originally promised. It's why you end up with a $700 million blowout in the redevelopment of Royal North Shore Hospital, a project first delivered in 2002, but because no one ensured it followed through, is now being done at an additional cost to taxpayers of $745 million. That's the need for this sort of accountability. It's also why the Liberal Nationals will overhaul the Cabinet reporting framework for all major infrastructure and service commitments to allow for independent verification of costings, clear statements on the costing impact on forward estimates, and quarterly progress of and briefings on time and cost variations. Put simply, there'll be no defence of ignorance under the next Coalition Cabinet. The other key aspect to consider in this discussion is the accountability government owes to the electorate. When fixed four-year terms were first proposed by the Balance of Power Independents in 1991, they believed the reform would end community frustration with early elections and provide certainty for government to act upon. They were good reasons then, and they remain so today. It's why I continue to support fixed four-year terms. However, at that time, no one envisaged how a Labor machine could and would manipulate the fixed-term system to protect maladministration, political inertia and incompetence. With a one-seat majority in 1995, Labor fully embraced the fixed four-year term. But during its second and third terms, Labor set about to thwart its intent. It perfected the practice of only ever applying effort to the community's concerns in the last year of the cycle, the period it cynically calculated when voters would start to focus on a government and party's performance. So, for instance, in the lead-up to the 2003 election campaign, it finally directed additional resources to reducing surgery waiting lists across the state. It did remarkably well. It got long-term waits, waits of more than 12 months, down to virtually zero. But once that 2003 election was won, the money was turned off, literally in the Easter of 2003, starting up in Armidale. For its own benefit, not the public interest, Labor delays economic and social benefits to the community until it suits their campaign purposes. Labor's manipulation of the system raises questions of reform for the state's fixed four-year terms. How do we ensure that a government works for 208 weeks and not just the last 52 weeks of such a term? One option my colleagues and I have been considering is the concept of recall. The spectre of being forced to an election by the community could, I believe, provide the stimulus needed for government, even a New South Wales Labor government, to perform throughout its term, as well as provide the public with a safeguard against political abuses. A number of US states have the provision, and the recall mechanism was introduced in the Canadian province of British Columbia in 1995. Recall provisions, you might remember, first came into public prominence in recent times, in 2003, when Californian voters recalled Governor Gray Davis, an action that led to the introduction into US politics of Arnold Schwarzenegger. The issue of recall mechanism for New South Wales and questions surrounding it are worthy of consideration in this state, and my colleagues and I are prepared to have that debate. The public should have a say on issues of whether they should have the power to bring on an early election in circumstances where government is failing to fulfil its mandate or its purpose. They should have a say on whether it's truly democratic for the community to be forced to bear the costs of government that's become corrupt and inept. And they should have a chance to have a say on the type of recall provision that may best suit New South Wales' system of government. But rather than just pose the questions, the Liberal Nationals intend to act. A Liberal National government will establish an independent panel of constitutional experts to advise on the potential for recall elections in this state. The expert panel will report on suitability, effectiveness, and models of recall, and advise on the best way of achieving constitutional reform, including putting the question to referenda at either the 2012 local government or 2015 state elections. It's a debate we need to have, and I look forward to hearing the public's views. Which brings me to the final pillar of our approach to government, to governance, which is honesty, government and governance. In the private sector, risk management professionals increasingly see company culture rather than the regulatory compliance as the impetus for good governance. The same applies to government. No amount of legislation or regulation can guarantee honesty in public administration or government. Ultimately, it comes down to culture, and culture starts at the top. So many of New South Wales Labor's problems stem from, for want of a better term, its corporate culture. Successive state Labor leaders have tolerated and even fostered a dysfunctional culture that not only condones but rewards those who pursue power simply for its own sake. A dysfunctional culture that tolerates and even encourages deal-making with scant regard for probity and public interest. A dysfunctional culture that's facilitated the rise and rise and rise of a minister like Joe Tripodi, who seems to be directly or indirectly linked to most government scandals. With each ministerial scandal, the public watch seemingly exasperated while Labor premiers try and deal with their team's bad behaviour. But their response seems in the end, results in more public frustration, as those premiers seldom, if ever, see any responsibility taken or any sign that the culture is changing. Every time a premier turns a blind eye to an issue of maladministration or malfeasance, the donor given improper access, the advisor appointed to the public service, the stakeholder given undue influence, they give the green light to a culture where the ends have been allowed to justify the means. And the community cost of that malaise is self-evident and disturbing. There's no doubt that this state is in dysfunction because of Labor's culture. The budget's broken. People talk about being fearful of getting sick because they have no faith in the hospital system to help them, which is unfair on those who work hard in the hospital systems. People I described yesterday as the real saints of the system who deliver the best possible care despite the lack of care and attention by government. Stress levels have gone up in suburbs, as late trains, as congested roads don't allow parents to pick up their kids from childcare centres or schools or get home on time. It's a cost we can no longer bear. The community in this state deserve much better, commencing with honesty about where we are, where we need to be, and what needs doing. And there's no better place to start. There's no better place to start the change in New South Wales politics than ridding the state of Labor's decisions for donations culture. New South Wales needs sweeping reform of campaign finance if public faith is to be restored in our political process. Whether they acknowledge it or not, whether they like it or not, concerns about Labor's fundraising and its impact upon decision-making has sapped people's confidence in government in this state. Campaign finance reform will return the public to our system of government again. It will replace vested or moneyed interests with public interest when it comes to making decisions in this state. And it's why I'm arguing for fundamental reforms, caps on both donations and campaign spending. It's why I'm committed to deal with both the supply and the demand side of campaign finance. If parties can't spend the money, there's no need to raise the money. If we impose limits on the obscene amounts of money spent during election campaigns, Labor could end its 14-year gorging of donations. The Liberal Nationals are also determined to take steps to prevent government shifting campaign costs onto the taxpayer. We'll empower the state's Auditor-General to independently review and approve guidelines governing all taxpayer-funded advertising in the 12 months leading up to the state election campaign. The Auditor-General will be empowered to send the bill for advertising campaigns that infringe those guidelines to the head office of the party responsible. While our last two premiers have talked about donation reform, neither was prepared to act, despite, even in the case of the current incumbent, a handshake deal during a public debate. The only reason action's being delayed is Labor's inability to control its fundraising addiction, a cultural fear that it has of merit-based selection and decision-making, and the false hope that it can buy its way back into office. There's no need for delay, and there's every need for leadership. In 1978, as Terry Sheehan knows, this state did not wait for national action to introduce campaign finance laws. We shouldn't have to wait for national action today. It simply requires the type of leadership I want to define my future government. Leadership motivated by a commitment to rebuilding public faith in politics and public administration, and determined to bring Parliament to its rightful, to return Parliament to its rightful owners, the people of this state. Ladies and gentlemen, earlier in my remarks, I quoted Acton, one of England's more colourful political characters, for those who've read about him. Perhaps more historian than politician, Acton nevertheless possessed an amazing, if not uncanny, ability to understand the significance and to explain the often intangible processes of government. And I want to finish with one of his less famous but equally relevant words. Acton said, "Liberty is not the power of doing what we like, but the right to do what we ought." There's a lot of work that needs to be done to unleash the potential of New South Wales, and it starts with getting the business of government in order. The precursor to good government is good governance. The most fundamental precursor to good governance is a positive ethic of transparency, accountability, and most importantly, honesty. And the state's next Liberal National Government is determined and dedicated to restore good government and good governance to the people of this state.
Many thanks, Mr. O'Farrell. The speech will be up on our podcast tomorrow and will be published in due course when Anne puts out the Sydney papers. And so we come to questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. Thanks for making a speech on governance interesting.
You've got a sad life, Jeremy.
But you spoke a bit about the problems we all have here, I guess, hospitals, roads, transport, schools, and you spoke about the lack of governance in that area, and all of those points are well made, obviously, but there is obviously another problem here which links New South Wales to the other states, in a sense, is how do you handle the public sector unions, because, as you know, what's common about all those problems is the existence of strong public sector unions. Now, what's the opposition's outlook in that area?
Always ask the good questions. Jared, I start briefly with a bit of history. When we were last elected, we faced exactly the same problem, and as I suspect Labor councils around this country do when confronted with governments that aren't affiliated with them, they are faced with two choices, to either work with them or work against them. And when you have fixed four-year terms, it's a pretty pointless task, or at least a costly task, to try and work against them for 208 weeks. So what we saw last time, led by a Labor Council under the leadership of Michael Eason, was an understanding that they had to work with government and that the best way to secure their members' jobs in the public administration sector or public sector was to ensure that what was being done well. So in the railways, I think we had a one-day stoppage, despite all the significant reforms that occurred in that area. So, look, our task there, firstly, Jared, is to get ourselves elected, and not just elected, elected with a strong and overwhelming mandate for the reform that New South Wales needs. Our next task is to ensure that we lift and secure better, we lift the professionalism, we unleash the potential of our public service. Part of Labor's dysfunctional culture is too many people have been parachuted into the public service without merit selection, getting in the career paths of good public servants who are prepared to make decisions, who are prepared to move on, and overlaying it all, Jared, is a culture that has had public servants, particularly since the Cross City Tunnel fiasco and the axing of Paul Ford, understand that putting your head up, making decisions, provides no reward. So, you know, we are determined to restore professionalism, we're determined to unleash the potential. We've already said, Jared, and you'll remember this from your days as a public servant, that we're going to reinstitute a public service commission in New South Wales to work on that, to guarantee the jobs that independently advertised, outside advertised, that selection panels are making decisions on merit selection and to work in liberty professionalism. Jared, ultimately, though, we'll face the same challenge that the private sector does. which is you have a workforce and you want to get the best possible performance from that workforce. And we need to adopt some of those private sector practices into the public sector. We need to sit down with people and set some goals about their performance. We need to work with them to ensure that they reach those goals. And if they don't reach those goals, like the private sector, the response will be to work with them to lift their performance. That's how the private sector does it, Jared. It's the way in which productivity is lifted, is worked in other areas. And ultimately, the final answer to your question is that government simply has to have political will. Government has to have the will to argue the public interest. And if there's one message I want to leave you with tonight, is that my colleagues and I fully understand that we're going to get one shot at this. We get a shot to win the next election campaign. We get a shot at delivering what we're going to promise. We're not going to promise what we can't deliver, but we're going to ensure that what we promise, what we deliver, and every step we take in government is guided by what's in the public interest, not some partisan interest or not the interest of some union movement or some employer group. It's about the public. It's about putting the public first. It's about delivering to the public's needs. And in my view, that will ensure that my colleagues not only get that first shot, but get a second shot, and it's going to take 8 years at least to fix the mess this state is in after Labor.
Barry, in your search for transparency, to what extent do you intend to increase the power, the role and the staffing of the Auditor General?
Well, the Auditor General is important. Frankly, I think both the Auditor General and the Ombudsman, statutory officers alike, do an extraordinary job here with limited budgets and with limited resources. Just as we want the Auditor General to be involved in putting some constraints on the politics of taxpayer-funded advertising, just as the Auditor General has been tremendous at blowing the whistle on cost blowouts, on political interference in projects as diverse as a billing system for Sydney Water that I think from memory cost $70 million and was never put into operation, or the continuing delays that we see with the delivery of rail contracts, rail carriages. That's to continue. The Ombudsman, I think, is doing so good a job that in the response to the Wood Commission, I'm glad the ABC's left, in response to the, it's for my press secretary, but in response to the Wood Commission, the only recommendation not picked up by the state government was to make the Ombudsman chair of the Child Death Review Team. I have no doubt that decision, unsupported, unjustified, has been made because the Ombudsman has had the temerity, particularly in the area of FOI, to actually drive reform, expose wrongdoing, and press for change in a way that the government doesn't like. Well, some of my colleagues who have been around longer than others who are newer, the ones that have been here longer are getting used to it, the ones that are here more recently are pushing for more of it, understand that what I'm about is constraining the politics, what I'm about is greater transparency, what I'm about is more of what the Ombudsman and the Auditor General are doing, because I think that will actually drive us for better performance. I believe in competition. I think competition produces the best in most of us. And if transparency in reporting on the way in which services operate, if we have the Auditor General and the Ombudsman nudging us in the right direction, I think that's good for us, but better still, it's good for you and the people of New South Wales.
You made so many important and fundamental comments that I believe strongly you should really debate this in a one-hour TV program with your opposition. Can you arrange that?
I don't think YouTube's view that much, but the serious point there is that none of these issues ever get debated, least of all in this building.
Why not?
Because what is described as debate, I think, in both chambers, with all due respect to the upper house, are set-piece speeches, and in fact the standing orders, which hopefully in the lower house are about to be reviewed, get in the way of having genuine debates. You can have people get up in the parliament on important bills and simply slander and defame those opposite, not actually address the issues altogether. So that is a problem. The second problem I think we all face as a community in the lead-up to the next election campaign is there will be a debate. I have no doubt it will be a Friday night debate, they'll be buried, with all due respect to the ABC, who I love dearly, on state line, and it'll be so far out in the election campaign as to guarantee that whatever happens in that debate won't have a big impact on the campaign. Now, contrast that with the way in which the American system operates, Contrast that with the way in which systems elsewhere operate. There is an argument, not for 1 hour debate on TV, I wouldn't want to inflict that on anyone, stick to Grey's Anatomy. What I'd, or Spicks and Specs, or what I would, showing my age here, what I would encourage is that there ought to be, as there was in the last federal campaign, a series of debates held around the place, open to whoever wants to come, shadow minister against minister. I've no doubt my team outstrips their team. And a number of debates between the leader of both parties, the alternative premiers of New South Wales. When I put that, at least the second part of that, to the premier during a public debate we had at a pub in Balmain, he politely declined. And that speaks volumes for the way in which our opponents operate government. Look, Terry Sheehan's in the room. And Terry represents another era of Labor. I don't mean that in an unkind age way, but Terry Sheehan was a country member. Terry Sheehan, without even talking about it, I have no doubt, built his career. Throughout his career, including that last election that he regrettably lost, would have been engaged in debates, would have been engaged in public meetings throughout his electorate, throughout the whole time. They're virtually gone from government and politics, and in part they're gone because of the obscene spending that happens during election campaigns, where election campaigns these days are simply carpet bombing TV ads from both sides, and there's no real engagement with the community. One of the other benefits, I think, of capping campaign expenditure in the way that it's done in New Zealand, in Canada, in Britain, is you can actually put the public back in the centre of election campaigns as well. You can actually put some controls on us and require us to get out and explain ourselves, whether hopefully in 1 hour debates on TV, but I can't imagine anyone's watching, or at least in halls, in pubs, in churches, wherever you want it to be across this state. Well, there are arguments there, and I am an upper house reformist in the sense that I once argued for its abolition. I no longer argue for its abolition. What I prefer to argue for is that both chambers of Parliament operate effectively and efficiently. And what's wrong with the current system? Now, Westminster government is based on the fact that governments are formed by having a majority in the lower house. The lower house is meant to be the highly political chamber. And the upper house, whether Senate or House of Reps or whether Senate or Council or House of Lords, I suppose, Michael, is meant to, besides being political, to have some deliberative view. Well, with due respect to those of my upper house colleagues who are here, we have, done a Galileo with Westminster as well. Governments are still formed by a majority in the lower house, but the major political argy-bargy is upstairs. There's no real deliberation in the sense of a house of review. It's major horse trading, whether about shooting ranges in the Southern Highlands or about bills to stop kids being smacked. It is literally horse trading. That's not how upper houses are meant to operate. It's not how Parliament's meant to operate. And what it should be about is ensuring that we do get genuine debate going in the lower house. It should be about ensuring that we can have committees of the lower house to consider issues and not have to always refer them to upper house committees. And it should be about ensuring that the upper house can do more of that deliberative role that I think they've done well in the past. There is an issue too, can I say? Look, I accept this point that, although I make jokes about it from time to time, that as a member for a lower house seat, notwithstanding my role as Leader of the Opposition these days, is that you can at times take a particular perspective on an issue. A perspective that perhaps is more local, more democratic, more community-focused. And sometimes, that may not be the right perspective. You may need to take a higher perspective, an elevated level, an elevated view, a long-term view. I think that's where the upper house can also come into its own right.
State budget. There just doesn't seem to be enough tax revenue to pay all the necessary bills. How are you going to go about resolving that?
Well, Mike Baird could have an hour-long... forget the debate, because he'd need the whole hour to explain, but there's no shortage of tax revenue. There's been no shortage of tax revenues. The real tragedy in New South Wales is the fact that for the first 12 years of this 14-year term, there were record revenues. So good that they received $17 billion, $1,700 million more than they budgeted for in each of their budgets. Now, imagine what we could have done with $17 billion. Forget the metro to forget what I'm now calling the metrosexual to Rozelle. Forget the metro to Rozelle. We're going to have metros all over the place. We could have built rail lines in the northwest and southwest. But instead, It was wasted, and it was wasted because, as Mike Baird will tell you, no budget discipline, no budget ever came in on budget. Not on the revenue side, but importantly, not on the expenditure side. Where's the money gone? Well, as I said before, $1 billion went on a rail project that was meant to cost $1 billion less and travel double the distance. Almost $750 million going in a hospital blowout simply because it was delayed. $70 million on a computer system for Sydney Water that was never used. $100 million on an electronic ticketing system for the transport system that never came to fruition. You know, I can give you the list. So the issue is not the revenues that are coming in. The issue is the way in which the money is spent, the discipline with which is approached. If New South Wales had been the company, we would have had the receivers in long ago, and we'd be closed by now. You couldn't run a business. You couldn't run your family in this way. And our argument last year, when with Mike Baird and with Greg Pearce, our shadow treasurer and our shadow finance minister, in stark contrast with Labor's treasurer and finance minister, Eric Ruzindal and Joe Tripodi, who have no direct experience in running an economy or running budgets or with numbers other than party room numbers. We have in Mike someone who spent 18 years in a bank, and that was honourable in those days. And we have in Greg Pearce someone who spent slightly longer engaged in the law, but engaged in the law in relation to M&As, understanding what you need to look out for. And as they argued in our economic framework for the state, you know, if we want to make some decisions about where the state's going to go, you need to make those decisions based on what's in the long-term interest of the state. You don't do, as Labor did in the mini-budget, slash infrastructure projects, raise taxes and charges on business and families at the precise time every other state is doing the opposite. And when you start from a position where our infrastructure is in worse shape and where our taxes and charges make us less competitive than our two closest state neighbours, Victoria and Queensland. So that's the problem about not having a framework. It's the problem of not having goals as to where you want to go and understanding that the way to get there is to apply the discipline that you apply in your life, I imagine, that most of us apply in our families, and that most of you who are still in business and have the doors open apply on a regular basis to business.
There's another institution that's crucial to accountability and transparency, and that's the opposition. And I'm sure you agree it's central to having a strong government and in the next term, I would imagine, with you in opposition. What specifically do you do to strengthen the opposition to hold you at
night? Well, I think the mere fact that rather than having FOIs come back saying that we won't give you this information because, not that it's cavalier confidence, but that it might in future be cavalier confidence, the fact that there'll be greater transparency and accountability is going to keep me, but more importantly my future ministerial colleagues in this room, on our toes. Transparency and accountability, being able to get access to the information, being able to get a set of budget papers that enable me to stand here tonight to explain to you a single program in the state and how it's tracked since 1995 when Labor first came to power, something impossible under the current reporting process, will be powerful in the hands of opposition. But what I'm banking on, the reason I'm committed to it, is I think it's even more powerful in the hands of a government that's got its focus on the people of New South Wales, not simply on retaining office. People who disobey the rules deserve punishment. That's how I explained it to the kids when I got home that night. Parents are always exposed to hypocrisy. It's one of the joys of parenthood. Look, what's important is to ensure that parliamentary chambers go back to being what they're meant to be. Debating chambers, they're meant to be about eliciting information, and question time is meant to be the key accountability measure of responsible government. Now, it's meant to be the time when ordinary members, these days limited to the opposition, in the old days across the parliament, would hold the executive to account, would seek to have explanations produced for what were perceived to be problems within their electorate, their region or the community. And I can't remember the last time that happened. It certainly hasn't happened since I've been a member of this place, since 1995. Even independent members now get up with Dorothy Dix's. So even those to whom some in the community look as political paragons are playing the same games as Labor backbenchers. Now, that says to me the system needs changing, and if you can't have that accountability mechanism right, question is not why you'd abolish the upper house, it's why you'd abolish, why you wouldn't abolish both houses. And I, for one, don't believe that's the course of action that should be taken, because I don't believe that more centralised government in Canberra is either in the interests of those who rely upon services in the state, and because I'm old-fashioned enough to have studied history in the Federation debates, I also think that it puts too much power in the hands of an executive, a federal executive, compared to the rest of the community. I believe in checks and balances, I believe in a balance of power, but above all I believe in those things we're talking about tonight: transparency, accountability and honesty. And if we get it wrong, you deserve to give us a big kick. But you can't do that. You can't hold government to account if you don't have access to the information in the first place.
Well, we're getting to the end now, so just finally...
It's been thinking about this. This will be the kicker.
It's a long way to go, isn't it? You got around two years to the next election. What's the date of the next election?
26th of March, 2011.
So you've got
104 weeks, but who's counting? Besides me.
So how are you going to fill that out? And you've got a federal election probably 3 or 4 months before then. It must be difficult to, in the current climate.
Well, no, look, what is you know, look, the other point that I thought I was about to be asked about is what's not difficult this term, what's not difficult this time, is that the Liberal Party and the Coalition have their own house in order. You know, I don't just believe in transparency, accountability and honesty when it comes to public administration. I believe it should be practiced in our own backyard, and I acknowledge my party president here this evening, who I noticed halfway through the speech, Nick Campbell. And with Nick and with others, we have fundamentally reformed the Liberal Party. It is a long way from where it was 2 years ago, and I know there are sceptics in the community, but just as we saw sceptics about the reunification of Germany, the longer time goes on, the more that scepticism dies, the more we demonstrate that we have applied the principles of transparency, honesty and accountability in what we're doing. The second thing, of course, is that the coalition is close. We don't waste time, we don't waste energy fighting each other. Sure, occasionally, the odd, very odd, federal member intervenes, but we don't let that distract us. They seem far too distracted on their own. And so the coalition will not be an issue this term, because at a state level where you have optional preferential voting, you can't afford three-corner contest, because votes are leaked, votes are wasted, and they don't follow through as they do in federal campaigns. But more importantly, every single one of my parliamentary colleagues, front bench and back bench alike, are united, are focused and disciplined, and determined this time to give people a real choice. Determined this time certainly to win, determined this time to throw out the Labor Party, but more importantly determined to ensure that the public come that next election have a clear choice between what I'd regard as the policies of the past with Labor, no matter who they've got in the Premier's chair, and what we're offering, which is a cultural and ethical shift in government in New South Wales. And that's the support that I have within my team. It's the support that we'll offer as we go forward, and it's what I think, Jared, will not only get us across the line, but get us across the line convincingly.
Many thanks. I'll be very brief. Thanks to Barry O'Farrell for an important speech tonight, with a lot of initiatives and a very thoughtful speech as well. Your support for the Sydney Institute, I think it's probably 20 years now, has always been much appreciated, and it's great to see a politician who actually turns up and sits down in an audience and listens to other people talk. And Barry's been a strong supporter of the Institute for many years, and often turns up as part of his busy itinerary at our weekly functions and at our annual dinner and events like that. So I'd just say for tonight, well done. I think you concluded with an important point. There's not a lot that opposition leaders can do, but opposition leaders can reform their own party, and they can enhance coalitions where they exist. And I think in recent years you've done that, and that's going to be of considerable importance to the Liberals and the Nationals in New South Wales. So for tonight, congratulations on keeping us awake on governance, which isn't easy to do, but I followed what you said with a great deal of interest. I thought it was very thoughtful. And also, of course, for an O'Farrell-led government, very challenging. But tonight, well done, and best wishes. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.